The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Oscar Edmondson and I'm joined today by Katie Balls and James Heal. So we've just had the news announced that there will be a by-election in Blackpool South. Former Conservative MP Scott Benton has resigned, setting up a by-election to replace him. Katie, another one which the Tories won't perhaps be looking forward to.
It's not great news for Rishi Sunak, but I think it was quite likely there was going to be a by-election. Now, ultimately, Scott Benton has chosen to quit, as opposed to go through the process of the recall petition that was happening otherwise. And therefore, I think Number 10 had been planning for the eventuality of a by-election. It's just that it's been brought ahead by the fact that Scott Benton just said he's going rather than facing this petition, which would probably most likely have hit the right number. Now, in terms of what to expect in this by-election, I think it's pretty safe to say that the Tories are, barring some crazy event, on course to lose it. The majority is only 3,690. So if you compare that with some of the huge majorities that recently both Labour or the Lib Dems have managed to overturn against the Tories, this should be, you know, a walk in the park. You wouldn't imagine that has too much campaigning, and it should be that it goes to Labour. Because in 2017, it was a Labour-held seat. It's one of those 2019 victories on that realignment, which by all current polling and focus groups does not look like it is here to stick. So will it add to this fatalistic narrative that the Tories are heading to a wipeout? I think, in a way, because the seat is a marginal one, it's not as though people are going to look at this and say, another historic defeat for the Tories. Imagine overturning this. This goes down in history as XX, you know, in a certain year. But of course, it just adds to this sense of decay and the fact that the Tories are not in a good place.
I think the real challenge here is, as Katie sort of says, is not really about how well the Tories do, but more about how Reform does. This is one of those classic seats in the north of England where UKIP, for instance, have done really well. It voted Leave in 2016. And I think that's why all eyes are going to be on Reform at a time when, you know, according to one poll, they're upholding the Tories among men. At a time, another one is giving them 15% compared to the Tories on 19%. Reform really ought to be overtaking the Conservatives here, which would be quite a statement. But I think that, you know, after so much talk about Reform doing one of the polls, it's really about translating those kind of psychological gains into actual realised electoral achievements. And that's what the big challenge is going to be. If Reform can't do a really good show here, more than 20%, you'd say, you have to wonder where they're going to make gains at an election.
Yeah, and I think there's, of course, Reform having to show that all the polls, which are currently quite generous compared to their electoral results, mean something. But then if you do get a point, if you think about how Reform in a YouGov poll last week put on 15 points, only 4 points behind the Tories, that has actually really freaked out MPs. It's almost as though everyone's got so used to these catastrophic polls that now you see a poll which would probably relate, you know, in terms of the Labour lead to the Tories being down to 50 seats. But because there's just been so many, everyone's like, oh, we've priced that in. Yeah. Things have improved. But how the Reform vote share went up in that one did freak MPs out. So if they do have a strong showing, it's just, and that's probably the bigger problem in terms of Rishi Sunak having panicked MPs and potentially losing a marginal to Labour.
And Katie, over the weekend, Jeremy Hunt announced that the Tories will protect the pensions triple lock should they win at the next election. What did you make of that announcement?
Yeah, it was interesting, Jeremy Hunt using this Sunday media round to say the triple lock will be in the manifesto. Now, the manifesto is in its fairly early stages. As I write in the magazine, there are, you know, five cabinet ministers who are now being charged for outreach on the areas they're focusing in on. I mean, obviously, Jeremy Hunt, not, you won't be particularly surprised, is in charge of the economy. Oliver Dowden is on public services. Claire Coutinho is on net zero and perhaps the ways to fight Labour on it. And then you have Michael Gove on the union, and you have James Cleverly focusing on crime. So why are they announcing a policy now? I think that if you look at what happened in the days before, Jeremy Hunt in an appearance suggested that the triple lock was something they would have to keep under review because of how costly it is, and therefore it's not something they could guarantee, but if you can grow the economy and so forth. I think the way he was talking and the way the question was phrased was long term, but you combine that with the spring budget. And I think one of the probably less noticed problems of the spring budget, away from the fact that Tory MPs were just unhappy income tax wasn't included as a cut, is the fact that there was nothing there for pensioners. Now, lots of people listening to this podcast might say, "Oh, pensioners have it so good compared to younger people and so forth." But as a former minister put to me, what is the number 10 strategy right now? If you're doing a call vote strategy in terms of trying to limit a Tory wipeout and consolidate your core vote, well, you don't go around, in their words, pissing off pensioners. And I've spoken to some who've been out campaigning for local elections saying, you know, they're having pensioners slam the door in their faces because of that budget. I think there was a phone-in recently by Martin Lewis, the money expert, on ITV, and most of the calls were really pensioners saying, "Where was the offering for me?" So I think there are nerves in CCHQ and number 10 right now that they might inadvertently manage to upset probably one of the only voter groups they can really rely on right now. And you combine that with the comments on the pensions triple lock, and I think it makes perfect sense that they felt Jeremy Hunt should make this big statement on Sunday that it is definitely going to go ahead.
And James, moving on to the news today, which... The talk in Westminster is all about Chinese cyber attacks after the Sunday Times reported over the weekend that China has targeted senior politicians ahead of the election this year. We've heard from some of those senior politicians, and we're expecting Oliver Downe to give a statement, I think probably around the time this podcast airs. But what have you made of the story?
Well, there's different angles to it. I think, you know, the two news hooks for this, one of which, as you say, there is confirmation that parliamentarians were among those targeted by China, but second of all, again, the proof that the Electoral Commission attack of 2021, first revealed in 2022, was actually believed to be at the behest and instigation of Chinese hackers. And I think for those China hawks, I've spoken to a couple, and they see this as validation. They're also a little frustrated at how slowly the wheels have turned in this respect. Some are also, you know, people like Simon Clark have gone public, and they've tweeted things like, you know, saying every time we do a reset of our relationship with China, something else happens, whether that's Hong Kong, the Uyghur atrocities, now this. And so that's obviously, I think, a not so subtle jibe at the likes of David Cameron, who came in and was seen as a reset, James Cleverly, previously the Foreign Secretary, who was resetting those kind of UK-China relations. I think it's just going to be a persistent factor of all life. And I think what's striking is, first of all, how much this sort of follows on what we already previously thought or was reported on. But second of all, just how united the whole House is on all of this. And it is important. And I think obviously this is something that we've seen in the reports around when the election's going to be in terms of how secure our electoral cycle is, with some suggestions, I think first reported by Lara Spirit in the Times, that the Sunak government was getting was, don't do an election in November because we don't want it to coincide with the US elections and that's too much of a threat. So this is the key thing. I think it's reminded us how vulnerable our electoral systems are, which is why earlier this year the government set up its Defending Democracy Task Force. And really, I think it's just making sure that our public services are going to be able to withstand these kind of attacks. We all remember the NHS malware attack in 2018. According to the National Cyber Security Centre, we're overdue another such attack. So it's going to be, I think, something we see more of in the future. Not least, of course, because people were reminded last week with the different technological failings involving Greggs, for instance, you know, another national institution. So I think we're going to see more of this stuff in the months and years ahead.
Yeah. Do you think this is the start of maybe a more hawkish approach to China? I mean, the noises that Rishi Sunak have been making today are certainly more hawkish. And where perhaps does that leave Foreign Secretary David Cameron? I mean, we all know where he stands on China.
Well, tonight, David Cameron will be making a statement to the 1922 Committee of MPs and expect to talk through all this kind of stuff. I think it's just a reminder, really, of the terrible bind that we are in when it comes to China, which is that you can't... You have to deal with it in some respect. The UK, well, obviously there's so much economic involvement with China, but the problem is that every time people who are arguing for a sort of, not go as far as the golden era of 2015, but would like a closer relationship with China, something else like this crops up because the issues of security and economics are so interlinked together. So for the hawks, there's a certain degree of, I think, validation today, but also I think it's a reminder that the UK has adopted far too often a piecemeal approach in these kind of things rather than a whole strategic approach. You know, if you look at, for instance, how China's involvement in energy and national security sectors, for instance, over the past decade or so, it's really difficult to unwind all of that. So I don't think, Oscar, that this is going to really lead to much more significant, other than a reminder that, you know, there are very real foreign state hostile actors out there and they're working to undermine Britain in different capacities.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.